You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for April 13th, Saturday reading of the Arapahoe County News. My name is Tim Elliott. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Diagnosis debt. State bill seeks to reveal hospitals suing patients for unpaid bills. By John Ingold, the Colorado Sun. I'm dying. You're not. Those terminally ill ask more states to legalize physician-assisted death. By Jesse Bedane, Associated Press. Garth Doniato, unhoused friend, remembered. By Nina Joss. School resource officers pen mystery tale starring therapy dogs. By Rachel Lorenz. In Littleton, dramatic school board meeting highlights abuse allegations. By Nina Joss. Littleton Depot Art Gallery celebrates decades of art camaraderie. Also by Nina Joss. And various stories and articles. Colorado lawmakers are considering a bill that would prevent hospitals from publicly concealing their involvement in lawsuits against patients, following a joint Colorado Sun 9 News investigation into the practice. The bill, House Bill 1380, would apply to all debt collection lawsuits broadly, not just those over medical debt. It would require that the owner of a debt be listed among the plaintiffs in any lawsuit seeking to collect on the debt. About this story, Diagnosis Debt Colorado is a reporting partnership among Colorado newsrooms led by KFF Health News and the Colorado News Collaborative, exploring the scale, impact, and causes of medical debt in Colorado. The ongoing series builds on KFF Health News's award-winning reporting on medical debt in the United States. The bill passed its first committee hearing late Wednesday. Supporters say they hope the bill will make it easier for people to understand who is suing them and why in debt collection cases. When a consumer doesn't recognize the name, they often ignore the action, and that can make things worse for them, said State Rep. Javier Mabry, Democrat Denver, one of the bill's lead supporters. The proposal addresses an issue highlighted in the Sun and 9 News investigation. The investigation, which was done in conjunction with the Colorado News Collaborative and KFF Health News, found that UC Health, the state's largest health care provider, has sued thousands of patients per year over what it claimed were unpaid bills. But UC Health's involvement in the lawsuit was invisible to the public because the lawsuits were filed in the names of debt collection companies working for the health care providers. It is common practice for hospitals and other medical providers to work with debt collection companies to pursue patients for money. But providers like UC Health go a step further and assign the debt to the debt collector without relinquishing ownership of the debt. Based on that, the debt collection companies put their own names on lawsuits against patients, arguing that they are the proper plaintiff even though the money isn't owed to them. Since the publication of the investigation, The Sun and 9 News have learned of multiple other hospitals and medical groups in Colorado that engage in the same practice. UC Health officials told Sun and 9 News that the health system sued more than 15,000 patients between 2019 and 2023 over debts. Since 2000, almost none of the cases has listed UC Health as a plaintiff. Jackie Cooper Melmed, UC Health's chief legal officer, said it makes more sense to use the debt collectors' names on the lawsuits because they are the ones making decisions about the lawsuits. "We are not hiding anything," she said. "There is no mystery about what's going on here." But consumer advocacy groups say the system has the effect of concealing UC Health's involvement in the lawsuits, making it harder to track the enormous amount of litigation coming from the nonprofit hospital system. "This is not how responsible parties should act," Carla Weisenberg, the lead health care organizer at the Center for Health Progress, testified Wednesday before the State House Judiciary Committee. "Deceiving people who owe money should never be a strategy to hide affiliation." Weisenberg's organization currently has a campaign pressuring UC Health to stop suing patients. Multiple patients sued over UC Health debts told The Sun and 9 News that the practice of suing under the debt collector's name caused them confusion as they struggled to understand who was suing them and what the bill was for. Even then, the attachments provide the barest of information and are not on any kind of official form or letterhead, leading some patients to question whether the lawsuits were a scam. At Wednesday's committee hearing, Mabry, the sponsor, said this kind of confusion is common in cases where people are sued by entities who don't actually own the debt they are suing over. At a certain point, it feels like, what part of this is real? He said. That skepticism could cause people not to respond to the lawsuits, leading to default judgments and wage garnishments orders being entered against them. When the bill was introduced, it required the plaintiffs in a debt collection lawsuit to own 100% of the debt over which they were suing. After intense negotiation with representatives of the debt collection industry, though, Mabry moved Wednesday to drop that requirement. The version that passed the committee now says collection companies assigned the debt can be listed as plaintiffs so long as the underlying owner of the debt is also listed as a plaintiff. That change tempered much of the opposition to the bill, with prominent players in the debt collection lobby moving to more neutral positions. What we have at the end of the day may serve our needs and Colorado consumers as well, Alan Greenberg, an attorney who specializes in debt collection cases, told the committee Wednesday. The bill, which is supported by the Colorado Attorney's General Office, also contains two other significant provisions related to debt collection. One prohibits collection agencies from seeking warrants for the arrest of people being sued over debts, though it does not forbid judges from issuing warrants if a defendant is non-responsive to court orders. The second creates new regulations for so-called debt management service providers, companies that work with people to consolidate and pay off debts. The House Judiciary Committee approved the bill on a 7-4 vote, with Democrat Representative Mark Schneider of Manitou Springs voting no alongside the committee's three Republicans. The bill next goes to the full House, and it also must still pass in the state Senate before the legislative session ends on May 8. I'm dying. You're not. Those terminally ill ask more states to legalize physician-assisted death. On a brisk day at a restaurant outside Chicago, Deb Robertson sat with her teenage grandson to talk about her death. She'll probably miss his high school graduation. She declined the extended warranty on her car. Sometimes she wonders who will be at her funeral. Those things don't frighten her much. She didn't cry when she learned 2 months ago that the cancerous tumors in her liver were spreading, portending a tormented death. But later, she received a call. A bill moving through the Illinois legislature to allow certain terminally ill patients to end their own lives with a doctor's help had made progress. Then she cried. Medical aid in dying is not me choosing to die, she says she told her 17-year-old grandson. I am going to die, but it is my way of having a little bit more control over what it looks like in the end. That same conversation is happening beside hospital beds and around dinner tables across the country, as Americans who are nearing life's end negotiate the terms with themselves, their families, and now state lawmakers. At least 12 states currently have bills that would legalize physician-assisted death. 8 states and Washington, D.C. already allow it, but only for their own residents. Vermont and Oregon permit any qualifying American to travel to their state for the practice. Patients must be at least 18 years old, within 6 months of death, and be assessed to ensure they are capable of having an informed decision. 2 states have gone in the opposite direction. Kansas has a bill to further criminalize those who help someone with their physician-assisted death. West Virginia is asking voters to enshrine its current ban into the state constitution. That patchwork of laws has left Americans in most states without recourse. Some patients choose to apply for residency in a state where it's legal. Others take arduous trips in the late-stage throes of disease to die in unfamiliar places and beds, far from family, friends, and pets. It was late at night when Rod Azama awoke to his wife crawling on the floor, screaming. Pain from her cancer had punched through the heavy morphine dose. "Let me die," screamed his wife, Susan. As Rod rushed to hold her, The cries faded to repeated mumbles. "Heaven," she said, again and again. Susan pieced through her life's belongings, family heirlooms, photos, an antique spinning wheel, touching the memories of a final time. Then she decided where their next lives would be. She said goodbye to her constant sidekick, a small, fluffy Maltipoo named Sunny. Rod packed the dog's favorite toy, a stuffed bunny, as a reminder for Susan, who had to leave Sunny behind. Then the two flew to Oregon. The issue is contentious. Opponents, including many religious groups and lawmakers, have moral objections with the very concept of someone ending their life. Even with safeguards in place, they argue the decision could be made for the wrong reasons, including depression or pressure from family burdened by their caretaking. It's normalizing suicide, and it's incentivizing individuals to end their lives, said Danielle Pimentel of Americans United for Life. Pimentel raised concerns that pain isn't the top reason people choose an early departure, adding that policy should focus on bettering end-of-life care. Two national organizations lobbying for the bills argue it's about autonomy and compassion, some power over one's preordained exit. It comes down to the right of an individual to control their own end-of-life decisions, free from government intervention or religious interference, said Jeff Sugarman, national campaign strategist, Death with Dignity. Even though it's illegal in most states, a 2018 Gallup poll showed more than two-thirds of Americans support physician-assisted death. Only a small fraction of Americans nationwide, about 8,700, have used physician-assisted death since Oregon became the first state to legalize it in 1997, according to the advocacy group Compassion and Choices. Most are cancer cases. Others include heart and respiratory diseases. A third of people prescribed the medication cocktail don't end up using it. Gary Drake planned to. He began a Facebook post on February 13th with RIP. The 78-year-old was referring to himself. He was off to Oregon and wouldn't be responding to any more messages and calls. "I'm too busy and weak to do much more in this lifetime," he wrote. The jovial businessman from Florida had watched a close friend decline from late-stage lung cancer, driving him to and from chemotherapy until his friend shot himself. When Drake received a diagnosis around Christmas that his own lung, bone, and kidney cancer would end his life within 6 months, he didn't deliberate long. He signed off on Facebook. "I love you all. Say a prayer for me, and I'll see you on the other side. Bon voyage." The finality of the post prompted a flood of comments, as if he were attending his own funeral. "I know my dad and George are waiting to have a drink with you," someone wrote. Less than 3 years ago, Drake wouldn't have had the option. Oregon's residency requirement was rolled back in 2022, and Vermont's ended last year, after successful federal lawsuits argued it was unconstitutional for states to deny the service to non-residents. While debates to legalize the bills are playing out in Kentucky, Delaware, Maryland, and Iowa, among others, the advocacy organization Compassion and Choices is using the courts to try to remove residency requirements. "People are dying right now who don't have the luxury for endless deliberation," said Kem Celian, CEO and president of the group. While California has a bill before lawmakers that would allow out-of-staters to access the procedure, that provision in a Colorado bill was stripped out. Three states, including Colorado, have proposals to expand in-state access, such as allowing advanced practice registered nurses, not just doctors, to prescribe the medication. As Robertson discussed the topic with her grandson over noodles, he got teary-eyed. "If it became legal in Illinois tonight, would his grandmother be gone tomorrow? How does it differ from suicides that left empty seats at his school?" Robertson reassured him it would be the very last option as she embarks on a new chemo treatment. Then she explained the safeguards. Typically, two doctors must confirm that a patient has 6 months to live. The patient must verbally request it twice, with a waiting period that varies by state, and submit a written request with witnesses. At three meetings, a physician assesses the patient to ensure they are able to make an informed decision. The patient can be referred to a psychologist for an assessment if there are concerns. Patients must take the medications themselves. They lose consciousness within a few minutes and usually pass away within a few hours. Eventually, the teenager met her eyes. "Granny, I support whatever you choose to do," he said. Robertson was glad she had the conversation. When you just think of the words medical aid dying, a 17-year-old gets stuck on the dying part, she said. Dr. Jess Kahn is no stranger to the controversy and fixation on the dying part. Living on the border between Oregon and Washington, she has worked on over 200 cases between the two states. A quarter of those traveled to Oregon. Kahn has faced condemnation even from some fellow doctors who accuse her of violating the Hippocratic Oath of do no harm. Kahn's own mother is aghast on religious grounds, and though it's become a major part of Kahn's life, the two have only spoken about it once. For Kahn, it's a simple argument. She recalled watching a hospitalized patient with Lou Gehrig's disease, or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, slowly decline, tormented by an inexorable feeling of suffocation until her passing. "She didn't die the death she wanted to die," Kahn said. "I'm just so convinced that death itself is not the enemy per se," she said. "For me, the ethical principles upon me are beneficence, and that I feel that the relief of suffering is really what I'm supposed to do as a physician." As Drake prepared to fly to Oregon, after posting on Facebook, he told his 12-year-old granddaughter that their special word would be Lulu, a tease over her obsession with the clothing brand Lululemon. "Every time she saw it," he said, "that would be him looking down from above." The last conversation she had with him was like any normal conversation that she's ever had with him. "And that's the way she'll be able to remember him," said his son, Mitch Drake. Mitch flew to meet up with his father in Oregon in February. He thanked him for the life he had given him. They said their goodbyes. Gary Drake drank the cocktail as they played his song request, Toes, by Zac Brown Band. He put the cup down and sang, "I got my toes in the water, ass in the sand, not a worry in the world, a cold beer in my hand, life is good today, life is good today." Then he fell asleep. New evidence tampering charges filed against Aurora dentist accused of poisoning wife by the Sentinel. Prosecutors filed new charges against an Aurora dentist accused of poisoning his wife and killing her, accusing James Craig of trying to enlist the help of others to conceal evidence. Craig previously pleaded not guilty to prior charges of murder in the case. According to recent court documents filed Wednesday in Arapahoe County District Court, Craig faces two new charges of solicitation to commit tampering with physical evidence. From March 18, 2023 to June 15, 2023, Craig is accused of reaching out to at least one person and attempted to persuade them to tamper with physical evidence. Court documents redacted the name of the person he contacted to help him tamper with the evidence. The court documents do not detail specifics of what evidence Craig attempted to tamper. Craig, who investigators say fatally poisoned his wife's protein shakes with arsenic and cyanide to pursue an affair, pleaded not guilty to first-degree murder and evidence tampering in October. Craig was arrested in March 2023, shortly after his wife, Angela, was taken off of life support. Police began investigating Craig when his partner in his dental office, Ryan Redfern, allegedly told a nurse that Craig had ordered potassium cyanide even though he did not need it for their work. Craig also allegedly Googled questions such as, "Is arsenic detectable in autopsy?" before investigators believe he put arsenic in a protein shake for his wife. She survived, after which he ordered potassium cyanide with expedited shifting. He also tried to order another poisonous substance, oleandrin, which was seized by authorities. Arapahoe County Coroner Kelly Lear has said that Angela Craig died of poisoning from tetrahydrozoline, a chemical found in eye drops and cyanide. Redfern told authorities that Craig's dental practice was on the brink of bankruptcy at the time and that he had been having problems in his marriage. Investigators believe James Craig put arsenic in one of the protein shakes he routinely made for his wife for their workouts on March 6, and then he ordered a rush shipment of potassium cyanide that he told the supplier was needed for a surgery. James Craig had asked an office manager not to open that package, but another employee did, leading to its discovery and eventual disclosure to authorities, the document says. The delivery of a third substance he is accused of ordering, oleandrin, was intercepted by authorities after they began investigating him, the document says. Oleandrin is a poisonous substance found in the leaves of the oleander plant. James Craig told Redfern that he ordered the potassium cyanide for his wife and told a social worker that she had been suicidal and depressed since he asked for a divorce in December, even though neither of the couple's children said anything about suicide attempts, according to the arrest affidavit. Redfern also told investigators that James Craig was on the verge of bankruptcy and had been having problems in his marriage, according to the document. Angela Craig's sister, Toni Kofoid, told police that James Craig had drugged his wife about 5 years ago with an unknown drug because he said he planned to kill himself and did not want her to be able to save him. Kofoid believes that incident is what James Craig referenced in a series of texts between Angela and James Craig about her symptoms after she first fell ill on March 6th. According to the arrest affidavit, James Craig wrote, "Given our history, I know that must be triggering. Just for the record, I didn't drug you. I am super worried, though." Craig's trial was scheduled to begin in April 2024. Court officials said it's now scheduled for August. Garth Donato, unhoused friend, remembered. Whenever Garth Donato ate at Subway, he would order the All-American Club. When the sandwich came out, stacked high with turkey and ham, Donato would pull out his own bottle of ketchup, dunk the sandwich in, and enjoy. His regular sub was only one of many ways in which Donato became a fixture around the Arapahoe Village Shopping Center. A man of routine, his friends always knew where to find him, drinking a hot coffee in his window seat at Starbucks, watching television at the Garlic Knot Pizza and Pasta, or greeting visitors at the King Supers. Since his death on March 25th, when he was struck and killed by a car on East Arapahoe Road near the intersection of South Fairfax Way, countless daily rituals have been shattered, along with the hearts of those who call Donato a friend. Local resident Paul Rodriguez would see Donato most mornings at Starbucks, and when he did, would enjoy coffee with him. In the two orange seats by the window, the men developed a quiet friendship. "He was a good man," Rodriguez said. "He had a big heart. In a few words, he showed his love a lot. Good to know a man like that. He will be missed." Over 100 people came to two memorial events organized by friends and acquaintances to remember and honor Donato, who lived unhoused in the area near the shopping center. Although many didn't even know his name before his death, they lauded Donato for being a positive presence, an amazing soul, and a pillar of the community. "The guy's presence was a fire hose of good vibes, like the Buddha reincarnated into Santa," like he was visiting Earth from a more enlightened universe, one neighbor told the Centennial Citizen, alluding to Donato's long white hair and beard. I never spoke more than a few words with him, but just walking by him made my day better. Friends praised Donato for his humility, gentleness, and selflessness. Although he lived outside, neighbors said he never accepted any offers of food or money. On occasion, on very cold nights, he accepted an offer to sleep in someone's garage. We always tried to offer things, money, food, and he would never take anything, neighbor Alex Johnson said. He was so appreciative of just a simple handshake or a hug. Employees at the pizza restaurant said even when they tried to offer him things for free, he always paid for his order. Although some would assume otherwise based on his outward appearance and shopping cart full of belongings, including a miniature car collection, Donato had money. According to his brother Scott, Donato even had a condo. But instead of living in it, he chose to make his shopping cart his world. Donato was born in Buffalo, New York in 1961, Scott said. His family lived in Ohio briefly and then moved to what is now Centennial when Donato was still a kid. Donato went to Arapaho High School and then became a janitor there and lived with his father for many years. When his father died, a court ordered Donato to vacate the house so the family could sell the property. Scott said the family found Donato an apartment, but court records show an eviction was filed. Then the family bought Donato a condo, Scott said. He said Donato may have chosen not to live in the condo because of complicated family dynamics, or he may have just preferred a simpler life, living on the street. Donato's family would visit him regularly, but his lifestyle also allowed him to build a larger family in the community who supported and loved him in countless ways. Scott said it was heartwarming to see how many people came to the memorials for Donato and to hear their stories about him. Donato didn't share much with his family, Scott said. One man, he said, told the story of how Donato saved his life. The storyteller was homeless for a while, and Donato taught him how to survive on the streets. It was an amazing, different side of him that, you know, as family members, we didn't experience a whole lot of that, Scott said. It was very heartwarming and amazing just to hear those stories when we didn't really know that side of what was going on with him. For many others, Donato was a staple in their daily lives. Trish Voss said she would say good morning to him every day at 7:30 a.m. when she would open the Colorado driver's license office, where she works. She said Donato always had a smile on his face. On the day after Donato's death, Paul Rodriguez, who would see Donato at Starbucks, sat in his normal seat next to where Donato usually sat. "This is my last cup of coffee with him," he said. "I'm just sitting here, just remembering him." Families knew Donato, and kids loved him. A chalk drawing outside of the King Super shows Donato, with "Forever in Our Hearts" scrawled next to it. When one couple went to King Super's, Donato would always wait outside with their dog while they shopped. In the evenings, he would order dark meat chicken thighs from the deli and then sit in a chair by the front entrance, employee T.J. Watkins said. One father, Logan Strickney, said his family saw Donato almost every time they were out for the past 6 years. "We would greet each other with a few words and a smile," he said. "Our small kids received the biggest smile and the warmest greeting. He recognized them and watched them grow, and they knew him also." Centennial District 2 City Council member Tammy Maurer said, like many of her neighbors, she would always say hello and ask Donato how he was doing when she went shopping. At the memorials and in emails to the Centennial Citizen, several neighbors thanked the Arapaho Village businesses and community for how they treated the man, who in other communities may have been ridiculed or brushed aside. "When you walk into King Super's and he's sitting there because it's raining outside and nobody in King Super's cares, I'm telling you what, in Aurora or Denver, they wouldn't let him do that, neighbor Ken Moffitt said. They wouldn't let him sit in Starbucks and sleep in the chair. They wouldn't let him go to the garlic knot and feed him. This community, I love living here because of the people in this shopping center and the way they took care of Garth. Moffitt, who used to work as a firefighter and a paramedic in Aurora, said he had met a lot of cynical people in his career who thought those experiencing homelessness were lazy. I would just tell people, you're wrong. That's not true, he said. Donato absolutely was one of the kindest, most gentle people I ever met. And I'm really going to miss him because I used to come over here in the morning just to see if he was here. One friend of Donato's, Diana Rink, said she was touched by how many people came to the memorials to honor him. I can go on the rest of my life knowing how much this man has been loved and how much he was cherished in our community, she said. Several community members said the roads and parking lot near where Donato was killed are dangerous, and shared other stories of witnessing close calls or almost being hit by cars. The police are not pressing charges against the driver who hit Donato. The Centennial Citizen has requested the crash report from the police and has not received it. Beyond loving him, the community looked up to Donato. They said he was always kind, no matter the situation, and he was focused on the simple things in life that matter. He was happy with who he was, and he always had a smile to share. Many said they could learn from him in the ways they live their lives. He's just the most humble person in the world, said Voss from the driver's license office. If everyone can learn from Garth, this place would be better off, for sure. School resource officers pen mystery tale starring therapy dogs. Yellow police tape surrounded a table that held a half-eaten layer cake. Numbered evidence markers drew attention to the crumbs left behind. And, not so far from the scene of the crime, the tails of five uniformed police dogs wagged happily. The scene, recreated from the newly unveiled children's book entitled The Case of the Missing Cake, was the setting for a celebration of the story's creators, sponsors, and main characters at Smoky Hill Library and Centennial on Tuesday evening. Arapahoe County Sheriff Tyler Brown came down to boast about the book's authors, two deputies. The entire team is always thinking of something new to do, Brown said of his school resource officers. And this book is just that next iteration in how we provide a better service to our student population and to the citizens of Arapahoe County. SRO deputies Adam Nardi and John Gray wrote the book, which features the department's five therapy dogs to help children develop their emotional intelligence and inspire their love of reading. It teaches a lesson in empathy, Nardi told the Centennial Citizen. We just want kids to be more aware of how they're feeling and how other people are feeling. The school resource officer's K-9 program was started about 3 years ago with Rex, the Labrador who partnered with Gray. Since then, Zeke, Riley, Otis, and Bear have joined the force. Each dog is paired with a school resource officer and assigned to a specific school. All of the therapy dogs are trained for a secondary purpose as well. Zeke has been taught to detect electronics while the others can locate guns and explosives if needed. But showing up each day for students is their main job. Their presence isn't only for kids in crisis, but also for students experiencing the everyday ups and downs of school. SRO Deputy Travis Jones said, even a quick interaction in the hall with one of the therapy dogs can make a student's day better. Regarding the book his fellow officers wrote, Jones thinks it just might nudge reluctant readers toward a love of literature. They're going to be more invested in these books because it's people they know. It's animals they know, he said. This isn't some made-up character that they've never met. These are dogs that they're used to seeing every day. The 27-page storybook comes to life with colorful illustrations done by Gray and his sister-in-law, Jewel Nichols. But getting the book written and illustrated was just the beginning, Gray said to the small crowd gathered in a meeting room of the library. Raising the $38,000 it took to get 3,000 copies of the book printed was its own task. In the end, 13 local organizations and small businesses contributed to the project. The City of Centennial, for example, gave a $10,000 Broncos Youth Activity Grant to the endeavor. Cobank, Littleton Public Schools, Fit Republic Southlands, Arapaho Library, Sound Relief, the Pet PT, Back the Blue Canine Force, FOP Arapaho Lodge 31, Alameda East Veterinary Hospital, Doggy Delights, Scent Hound, and the Rotary Club of Centennial also provided assistance. A copy of the mystery tale, signed by the authors and illustrators, and stamped with the paw print of each dog, was formally presented to the sponsors at the event on Tuesday. Arapaho libraries will have copies of the book available for checkout, according to Ginger Delgado, a spokesperson for the sheriff's office. In addition, the book is available for purchase by students at all the elementary schools in the sheriff's office's jurisdiction, including Littleton Public Schools, Cherry Creek School District, and Byers Deer Trail School Districts. Priced at $20, the entire sale amount will go to Back the Blue Canine Force, a Centennial-based nonprofit that provides financial support to canine units. The Case of the Missing Cake is the first in a series of books Gray and Nardi have planned about the department's dogs, Gray announced at the event. This first installment is aimed at kindergarten through third grade students. Future books will target different elementary school age groups. Universities push enrollment deadlines amid FAFSA delays, by Jason Gonzalez. Colorado's two largest universities will push the deadline for students to confirm their enrollment by a month to June 1st. The announcements by the University of Colorado Boulder and Colorado State University Fort Collins follow a difficult free application for federal student aid season marred by glitches. The problems delayed when families could apply, and colleges haven't received the information they used to help families determine if a school's financially right for them. We are here to support our students, said Amy Hutton, CU Boulder Associate Vice Chancellor for Enrollment Management. We really want to make sure they have the support and the time they need to make the right decision. The U.S. Department of Education switched to a new FAFSA form this year, but the rollout has been slow and problematic. Families and students typically can start filling out the FAFSA in October, but the federal government delayed the application period this year until December 31st to create a new form. The federal government then announced a delay of student records that schools used to send out aid awards to families. The Better FAFSA, as it is now known, has been easier and faster to complete. Nevertheless, some students, such as those whose parents don't have Social Security numbers, have had issues finishing the form. The federal government has created a workaround for those families. Typically, about 7 million students nationwide fill out the FAFSA. So far, about 5 million have completed the form. Colleges across the state and U.S. began to shift numerous deadlines as FAFSA issues persisted. Hutton said moving the deadline will give students, especially those who are the first in their families to go to college or who have higher financial need, more time to consider their financial options. The state's two premier public universities aren't alone in announcing more flexibility for students amid FAFSA delays. Other Colorado public higher education institutions have already announced changes. For example, Fort Lewis College already pushed its enrollment deadline to June 1st. Other schools, especially regional institutions, traditionally are more flexible in admissions, but also have changed their deadlines this year, such as registration or when students need to submit housing applications. Pushing the confirmation deadline is more consequential for larger schools such as CU Boulder and CSU Fort Collins because they compete for a more selective pool of students. Heather Daniel, CSU Fort Collins Director of Admissions, said the May 1st enrollment deadline has been like a national holiday when students announce where they plan to attend college. Schools use the enrollment confirmation deadline as a way to understand the size of next year's incoming freshmen, which helps them plan. Pushing the deadline by a month also will impact students. The tighter schedule gives them less time to complete pre-enrollment tasks, Daniel said. It might seem a quicker turnaround for students to be able to complete next steps, like signing up for orientation, registering for classes, and getting their housing, Daniel said. It's just a matter of adjusting and, most importantly, accommodating students and families through the process. That's our primary focus. Statewide, other schools have tried to find ways to help families navigate this year. Metropolitan State University of Denver, which offers more flexible enrollment, has told students it will work with them through FAFSA challenges. Vaughn Toland, MSU Denver Chief Enrollment Officer, said many of the school's students apply well into the summer. The school has extended financial aid eligibility deadlines. "We're going to get this figured out, and we're here to support you," Toland said. The school, which is the most diverse Colorado institution and has a high number of students who are the first to go to college, has tried to communicate it will be flexible if students run into individual issues. Caroline Eglis, MSU Denver Executive Director of Financial Aid and Scholarships, said she wants students to know they won't get left behind because many deadlines are fluid. "And that's given them some peace of mind," she said. "But students should attempt to fill out the FAFSA," school leaders said. "The form is the only way students can truly understand their financial options for school," Hutton said. "I always recommend students fill out the FAFSA and see what aid is available to them so they can make an informed decision about where they want to attend and their ability to succeed when they do," Hutton said. In Littleton, dramatic school board meeting highlights abuse allegations. Parents call for the resignation of Littleton Public School Superintendent Todd Lambert during a heated public comment period on Thursday in the wake of allegations that a district paraprofessional physically assaulted students with disabilities on bus rides. Over a dozen speakers criticized the district for what they said were failures to prevent months of abuse to nonverbal children with autism. Jess Vestal accused the district at the meeting of failing to intervene to help her son as he was assaulted on a school bus. "These children, who cannot speak, were strapped in and tortured for months," she said. "Had anybody taken a day, an hour, 40 minutes to just check in? You could have stopped this." Vestal's son appears in video footage on March 18th, in which it appears paraprofessional Kiara Jones, 29, strikes him repeatedly on a school bus ride. Jones is accused by police of harming multiple students on a moving school bus in recent months. She faces a felony charge of assault crimes against an at-risk person in the third degree in one incident. The Inglewood Police Department, the charging agency, said it is investigating further to identify any and all victims and crimes. Brittany Yarbrough, who said her son came home with injuries after riding the bus, asked why the district hadn't monitored security camera footage from the bus for safety and compliance. "If you had, you would have seen multiple safety violations," she said. "You would have seen the brutal assault on a little boy. You would have seen the numerous accounts of abuse, but you didn't." After many parents spoke, Lambert attempted to respond. "We're shocked, saddened, and angry at what happened, that any student would suffer on any of our buses," he said. This is not consistent with the actions of over 2,000 district staff members that serve and love our students every day. There are no words to describe the gravity of what has happened, and we want to acknowledge you and let you know that we heard you. As he was speaking, a mass of audience members cried out, "Liar!" and "Shame on you!" and walked out of the meeting. In a letter sent to some district families on April 11th, Lambert said the district is deeply sorry and devastated by the incident. "You trust us with well-being and care of your children, and due to one individual, that trust has been strained and maybe even lost," he wrote. "We understand and acknowledge that." Jones, an employee of Littleton Public Schools, worked on the bus that transported children to the Joshua School, an independent organization contracted by school districts that serve students with autism and developmental disabilities. Rathod and Mohammadi LLC, a law firm representing several families, said the district failed to give credible suspicion of abuse the attention it required after parents raised concerns about the welfare of their children. The Joshua School, in a statement, said its staff requested a district review of bus video footage in January and was assured by the district that nothing out of the ordinary had occurred. Parent stories. Yarbrough said at the meeting that her son, Hunter, came home with unexplained injuries, including bruises, scratches, a bleeding ear, and a broken toe. "I know that there was a monster on that bus, and at least one other adult as well as multiple cameras," she said. Vestal, whose son Dax appears in the video, told the board that she has seen changes in his behavior and that she believes are due to trauma from the abuse. "We tried to go out to eat, and Dax was too afraid to sit down in the booth because it too closely resembled a school bus seat," she said. "I hope you see my son's terrified face every single night before bed, looking around for help, trying to unbuckle himself to get away from the hell that you called Route L-76. Many parents felt the district was tone-deaf during the meeting and criticized board members and the superintendent for their jovial demeanor in unrelated early meeting business, saying it was out of step with the sadness and seriousness of the criminal case. For instance, Board President Angela Christensen highlighted the district's participation in a national school board conference. "Littleton continues to shine at the state level and the national level," Christensen said. The statement was met by disbelieving laughter from a handful of members of the audience. Jessica McBride, a mother who said her son, Andrew, was harmed, was offended by the board's behavior. "I am, for one, deeply offended and disappointed by your lack of compassion in making us sit through a recount of all the good work that you've done for all of your students," she said. "Please tell me, what good did you do in the last few weeks for Dax Vestal? What good did you do for my student?" Blake McBride, Andrew's father, said he was disgusted with how the district has handled the tragedy. "The runaround I have received from your superintendent is telling us how this district runs itself," he said. "I am calling for Todd Lambert's resignation and the resignation of the transportation director." As McBride spoke, Christensen interrupted him to remind him of a policy she had referenced before the start of public comment, which prohibits speakers from making personal complaints against district personnel. "Well, that's silly because your district has hurt my kid," Blake McBride responded. "Where's my protections? You guys get protections, but I don't. Stop sitting here behind your policies and your privacy acts, whatever it is. It's all BS anyways. Pat yourselves on the back somewhere else because it's not accepted here." Tucker Yarbrough, 9, the younger brother of Hunter, said he no longer trusts the district leaders to make decisions for kids. My parents taught me that we should do everything we can to protect people who can't protect themselves, he said. I'm only 9 and I can do that. Why can't you? Why don't you do more to keep my brother safe? Speakers ask for policy changes that would require regular and thorough auditing of bus video footage. They also requested more training for staff working with special needs students, more unscheduled oversight of staff, additional mandatory reporting training for transportation staff, and training on evaluating and responding to parent or staff concerns. We shouldn't be relying on parents who are not present on the bus or students, many of which have known communication difficulties, to catch and report the abuse, one speaker said. For those that have the privilege of not knowing this, communication devices like the one my son uses don't have an icon on them for "My para abuses me on the bus." Some speakers also advocated for action on a state level, highlighting similar instances of abuse across the state. Lambert declined to respond to further questions from the Littleton Independent, citing his desire to not jeopardize the ongoing criminal investigation. Parents said they are going to continue pushing for change. Our children are nonverbal, but let me tell you, their moms are not, Vestil, the mother of the boy in the video, said. Our kids are safe because we did something. We pushed and we never stopped advocating, and this is just the beginning. Jones has a preliminary hearing scheduled for 1:30 p.m. on May 5th. Littleton Depot Art Gallery celebrates decades of art camaraderie. In the late 1960s, a handful of artists in Littleton made a decision that would lay a foundation for the Littleton arts community for decades to come. They had been meeting in homes and other buildings for years to make art together, but when they learned the Santa Fe Depot, a train depot, was at risk of being destroyed after the train ceased its route through Littleton, the artists saw potential in it. They created a plan to save the building and secured local funding to restore it. Today, the Depot Art Gallery sits by the courthouse near downtown Littleton, moved just a couple of blocks north of the train depot's original location. Now, a Colorado historic landmark, the depot is full of paintings, sculptures, photographs, and more. In its current show, the gallery celebrates 62 years of artists meeting together to create and the building's role as a hub for Littleton artists. The gallery is owned by the City of Littleton and managed by the Littleton Fine Arts Guild, a group that's grown from its original 10 artists to over 60 members today. Artists are juried into the guild and volunteer their time to run the gallery, which offers a free space for Littleton community members to enjoy art. At a recent reception, artists gather to appreciate each other's work and honor the building's history and the guild's legacy. The original guild was just people that wanted to paint, and the same spirit is alive today of pursuing art and making it better, said Peggy Deitz, who has been a part of the guild for over 20 years. Beyond painters, the guild includes people who sculpt, make jewelry, photograph, draw, and more. For many of them, being part of the group has helped them develop as an artist. I think being a part of something like this is so nice, to be able to share your art with other artists, said Pat Foster, who joined the guild last year. I think there's a lot of good artists in here, so I think you learn from other artists. Others highlighted the importance of the friendships they've made through the guild. As you get older, it's harder to make friends, so that's really good, said Ivy DeLon, who has been in the guild for about 7 years. And they're other artist friends. So, you know, you have your family, you have your yoga friends, and then you have your artist friends. During the event, guild members presented Sonia Ellingbow a commemorative award for her contributions to the arts community, longtime guild membership, and gallery support. A former writer for the Littleton Independent, Ellingbow's life has been distinguished by her involvement and leadership in many of the city's important civic and arts institutions. All your writing about the Guild and about the depot really kept us afloat, Deit said to Ellingbo at the event, thanking her for how she made artists feel when she wrote about their work. When Ellingbo joined the Guild, she had one child and another on the way. I was kind of confined at home with little ankle biter, she said. This was just my savior, to be able to come to talk to adults about painting for a day every so often and do some painting myself. When the Guild started rehabilitating the building, Ellingbo said she remembers spending part of the day painting, and then the group would come over and scrub for a while. She said she also remembers waiting in line for the gallery's first ever exhibit. It's been kind of a standard in my life since the mid-50s, and it's been a big part of my life, so I'm glad to see you're all supporting it, she said. Those of you who are members, it's great. Stay with it. At 93, Ellingbo said she still enjoys watercolor painting. She encouraged the current members to continue embracing art in their lives. Beyond just making it, she encouraged them to support other artists. My message to you all is to go out and buy art, Ellingbo said. Don't stay home watching TV. The gallery's 62nd anniversary show, which includes 45 pieces of art from Guild members, will be on display until May 18th. The gallery is open from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Tuesdays through Sundays. Thank you for joining us for the Arapahoe County News. My name is Tim Elliott.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.